Band or something?
Yeah. My new best friend here. My name is Sean Allen, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not an expert on alcoholism. But I do have an opinion or two. I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here and Bonnie to be here. It's kind of fun having an illicit weekend in a motel, you know. And this is this is nice. The spiritual breakfast. I mean, they don't ever ask me to be the spiritual speaker. And they never let me talk after people have eaten, you know. So I like to tell that to the committee to watch them kind of get nervous. Yeah. I'm really delighted to be asked to participate in an area assembly. I've been in service for a long time, and I love the people in service. There are two fellowships in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's the fellowship, and there's the fellowship of the Spirit. And the people in service are the ones who have joined the Fellowship of the Spirit. Like any human organization, there's about 5% of the fellowship that does 95% of the work, and they're the people in service. They also are the people who have the kind of sobriety that I want to emulate, kind of sobriety that I want. They're the ones who firmly believe that you only get to keep what you give away. And so I love to go to meetings and argue about the prudent reserve and singleness of purpose and how much the big book should cost and all that kind of stuff. It's great. I absolutely love it. And the people in service are the ones that stay sober. The people in service are the ones who have relationships that seem to work and be able to hold jobs and do all the things that we want to do when we get sober, because this is more than just sobriety that we're doing here. This is a way back into a normal life. And I really believe that. The people in service are the ones who are practicing the principles in all our affairs, and I'm honored to be asked to be part of this. I also love the theme of this assembly, anonymity. I love the thing in the 12 and 12, at the end of the 12th tradition, when it talks about what anonymity is. And anonymity is a spiritual principle, and it is the practice of humility. And what anonymity means is that I give up my need to distinguish myself, either within this fellowship or out there. What an anonymity allows me to be is a normal, ordinary human being, something that I was incapable of being or doing because it frightened me too much. And I really believe that it is the protective mantle under which we can grow and change here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe in it strongly. I am not at this podium because I'm extraordinary in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm here because I'm typical. Alcoholics Anonymous is a tribe. It's not my family. I have a real family out there that I got to deal with. Nobody seems to be interested in adopting them. And so I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous to learn how to be a family member, and you've taught me all those things. But Alcoholics Anonymous is not my family. Alcoholics Anonymous is my tribe. And it's a tribe that's glued together with tolerance. That's what makes it work. If I can learn to tolerate you, I can learn to tolerate me. If I can learn to like you, I can learn to like me. If I can learn to love you, I can learn to love me. And it's like any tribe, we have the beastly babies, the ones that need to be taken care of and fed and taught. And we have the ones that are the nurturers, the ones that prepare the food, the coffee, the cookies. We have the elders, and the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous don't just get old. What they do is they accumulate the commodity that keeps us sober. They accumulate sober experience. They go through things and they don't drink. And they teach us how to do that, things that look impossible for us. And then there are the storytellers. And I'm one of the storytellers. And that's my function within the tribe. And it's probably some of your functions too. The wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is it takes people like you and me, who aren't worth anything when we arrive, and it makes us useful. And that's been the most amazing gift that I've received in Alcoholics Anonymous, is my God, have you made me useful. I've always had a need to distinguish myself. I've always wanted to be something more than I was. I don't know why. From my earliest memory, I felt flawed. I felt defective. I felt like I had been damaged in the shipping. I come from an alcoholic household. My father was an alcoholic. I'd love to pin it on the old man, But I found that it's not his fault that I'm an alcoholic. The reason I found out that is that I have a brother who is 22 months younger than I am, who lived in exactly the same circumstances that I did. We were very close. And he's never been drunk in his life. He's a highly successful businessman with two children, and we're business partners now. So I've always had that example standing there right in front of me that it wasn't my father's fault. Damn! I've been trying to pin this on somebody all my life, you know? And the cold, hard fact of it is that I am utterly responsible for my disease. I am completely responsible for my disease. I may have been born with a kind of proclivity for it. You know, I might have been genetically programmed to be an alcoholic, but I'm the one who drank. I'm the one who took the drugs, you know. My father never suggested that I drink a quart of scotch a day. He didn't think it was a good idea that he did it. He certainly didn't want me to do it, you know. No doctor ever said, why don't you go to two other doctors and get the same prescription and abuse these drugs? He never suggested that. No minister ever said, why don't you get hooked on marijuana, Sean? Nobody ever did that. That was my solution. Those were my solutions to my problems. I am utterly responsible for my disease. And that also makes me responsible for my recovery. You know? Sooner or later, we got to find our own program. Sooner or later, we got to take what we're taught here and apply it in our own lives. And that's what I've been trying to do for some years now. I got drunk for the first time when I was 14 years old, and I absolutely loved it. I mean, make no mistake about it. The reason I'm standing here this morning is that I love to drink. I loved everything about it. I loved the effect. I loved the ceremony. You know, I loved the ice cubes. I loved the toothpicks with the garbage, you know. I loved the hors d'oeuvre trays, you know. I love those intense intellectual conversations we got into at cocktail parties, you know?
I really think we should appoint a woman to the Supreme Court.
You know, I love that. I love those intense relationships that sometimes lasted all night, you know? I loved everything about it. One of the things about me is that I am a shy human being. I didn't find that out until I got sober. Now, I would like to think that shyness is a psychological disorder. You know, I would like it to be beyond anything that I could do anything about. You know, that I was crippled by shyness. I'd kind of like to start one of those 12-step programs for shy people. I mean, we've got them for everything else. Why not, you know? It'd be really true. There'd be real quiet meetings because everybody'd be too scared to say anything, you know? They'd also be real small because nobody would show up. But I really would like it. I'd like to work through my shyness with a bunch of people. But see, what I found out about it is shyness is not a psychological disorder in my case. What shyness is an extreme self-obsession. See, I am so concerned with the effect that I have on you that I'm not going to do anything. You know? I also found the tyranny of the passive personality. What I found out is that if I stand in the corner of the room and you walk across the room to me, I own you. If I have to walk across the room to you, it's too much of a risk. Now, my shyness would manifest itself in a crowd like this in one of two ways. I would either go to the corner of the room and read a magazine, or I'd stand in the center of the room and entertain you. Either way, I didn't have to talk to you. Either way, I didn't have to go through the agonizing thing that is still agony for me today. I'm terrific with two sentences. Hi, my name is Sean. How are you? And then I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do after that. I don't know how to do a conversation. And, you know, I get to talk at Alcoholics Anonymous a lot. And in California, you drive a lot. I got sober in California. And if you knew my car, you'd see me drive into an AA meeting and park in the parking lot for a moment. And I'd sit there in my car and you'd think, isn't that wonderful? Sean's getting his spiritual message together. And what I'm actually doing is I'm sitting in the car saying, you've got to get out of this car, Sean. They've seen you. You can't drive out now. You know. And what would happen, what happens to me is I hate walking into a room full of people I don't know. I mean, I don't know about you, but I needed three drinks to do that. I can't walk into a room full of people. To this day, it terrifies me. And, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, when you start getting into service, you start doing things that you don't understand. Thank God, you know. One of the first things that my sponsor made me do when I was about a week sober is he made me stand at doorways and shake hands. Now, I would have much rather stood at the doorway. I would much rather stood in front of a firing squad than stand at a door and shake hands, you know. But I did it because I was scared of my sponsor. So I would stand at the Sunday night meeting and I would shake hands, you know, my wet hand. Hi, I'm Sean. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And commitments, when I got sober, I don't know what happened to them. They were for a year. A year. I stood at a door and shook hands. 52 times. And I hated every second of it, but I did it, you know. And nowadays when I'm a big hotshot circuit speaker and I get that kind of momentary thing before I walk into a room, some poor slob is standing at the door whose sponsor has made him do it. And he sticks out his head and he says, "Hi, I'm Fred," and he pulls me through the door. And he doesn't know he's doing it. He doesn't know he's performing an act of love. But that's what he's doing. That's what he's doing to people like me. They didn't tell me that when they told me to do it. Because if they'd have told me that, I would have thought it was sappy and stupid, and I wouldn't have done it. But they teach you things around here that you don't know you're learning, and I'm really, really grateful for it. I was 14 years old, and I didn't fit anywhere. I didn't belong anywhere. I was uncomfortable. I was tall. I was fat. I had crooked teeth and thick glasses, and I was weird. And I'd lived all my life under the crushing burden of potential. People have said, "You're so smart, Sean. If you just apply yourself, you could be anything you want to be, you know?" And that night I got drunk and I met my potential. I was everything I needed to be, you know? I didn't need to grow up. I didn't need to change. I found it instantly. I found it with a glass of Southern Comfort, man. You slam that back and you could be anything you wanted to be. One of the things that I noticed was my friends were going through puberty and it looked awful to me. So I skipped it. Yeah. I said, to hell with it. Yeah. When anything looked painful, I got drunk. It was real simple. You know, if it looked like it was going to be painful, I got drunk. When I was 17 years old, I started taking drugs. I'm from the generation that made drug abuse middle class. We snatched it out of the hands of black musicians and brought it into the family rooms of America. What our generation did was we expanded the definition of alcoholism. And when we started crawling into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, we expanded the definition of sobriety. And when I was 18 years old, I declared myself an alcoholic, and I didn't know that I had done it, but I said the phrase that only an alcoholic said. And if you're here and you're not sure that you're in the right place, if you've ever said this, you're in the right place. If you've ever heard anybody say it, you're looking at a drunk, and that phrase is, "I can control my drinking." Only an alcoholic says, "I can control my drinking." Social drinkers never deal with the concept. Social drinkers, if they make a fool of themselves whilst drinking, they stop drinking. You ever notice that? Isn't that weird? I was 18 years old. I'd been drinking for 4 years. I'd been taking drugs for a year, and I was in trouble with the chemicals. But the prospect of living without them was even more terrifying. And so I started the great obsession. And I didn't know it was a great obsession, but it was, to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't know about you, but that never went together for me. That equation never went together. I never did it, you know. When I was controlling my drinking, I was certainly not enjoying it. And when I was enjoying it, it was wildly out of control. I mean, I have never sipped anything in my life, you know. Yeah. I never heard about controlled drinking until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought controlled drinking was you drink all you can and try to control yourself. Social drinking, I thought social drinking meant you got home before you passed out. If I didn't wake up in your bathtub, I had been doing some social drinking, you know. Yeah. And that's the way I drink. You know, all I've ever wanted out of life is out. You know? I just didn't want to feel anything. That's been the problem with me all my life, is that I feel stuff. Stuff is too much for me, you know? I just wanted a cap on it. I just didn't want to feel quite so much. I didn't want to know that you could get to me as easily as you could. I didn't want you to know that there was something terribly wrong with me and that I didn't really fit here and I was actually a spy in real life. That what I was doing was I was pretending to be like you. And I wasn't. I could tell that. I could tell that by the way I could tell anything. I compared my insides with your outsides. And you were all doing just fine. You know, but there was something horribly wrong with me. There was a terrible secret. The terrible secret in my case was that I was crazy. I knew that. I was crazy, but I was careful. I knew that if you acted crazy, they took you someplace and they never brought you back, you know. So I learned social skills as quickly as I could so that you wouldn't notice that I was nuts. But occasionally it broke through and I did bizarre things and they frightened me. When I was 21 years old, I decided I had a talent that the world couldn't live without. Just before that, I had decided I was going to get the outsides together. The insides were never going to get any better, I knew that. I had stopped asking questions because I knew if you asked a question, they'd find out you were in trouble. So I've been making up answers for a number of years, and my solutions have always been worse than my problems. Now, there wasn't much hope of working on the outside. I told you I was tall, fat, thick, glasses, crooked teeth, weird. But it's amazing how far a little alcoholic self-will can get you. First of all, I was chewing a lot of amphetamines, so I dropped a lot of tonnage. You know, who wants to shut up long enough to eat lunch? And I got myself a job, and I saved a little money, and I got my teeth capped, I got a pair of contact lenses, and shazam, I was good looking. I like that. So I decided I'd go to New York. I had $50 in my pocket, and I arrived in New York, and 2 months later, I had my first Broadway show. Now, that's more than a fat little kid from Victoria, British Columbia ever dreamed of doing or being. And there I was. Now, if anything should have fixed me, it was that. The first opening night on Broadway and the first opening night party in New York should have fixed it. That's more than I ever dared to dream of. By the time I was 24 years old, I had done several Broadway shows. I was drinking a quart of scotch a day. I picked up a little non-habit-forming marijuana habit, and I was and I was working the docks. The doctors. God bless the doctors. Those jerks. I never did street drugs. I had insurance. I think it's stupid to buy drugs in alleys. I like to do them in the drugstores, you know? And I always had three of them. I had gotten a medical book, and I read what kind of symptoms were appropriate for the kind of drugs that I wanted, and then I went and told the doctor that I had that, and they would write a prescription. And then I go to the other two doctors that I always had, and I tell them exactly the same thing. They write the same prescription. And so I always had that stuff. I was always kind of mellow. Mellow and thin. And I was 24 years old, and I was buying the great lie of alcoholism. And the great lie of alcoholism is you've still got time. You can do this for another week, Sean, and then you got to straighten up for a week, and then you'll be all right. I was the kind of drunk that if you invited me to your house for dinner at some time during the evening, I would excuse myself and go to your bathroom. I would lock the bathroom door and go through your medicine cabinet. 20 minutes later, you'd either find me sprawled on the bathroom floor in a coma, or you'd have to peel me off the bathroom ceiling, depending on what I found in your medicine cabinet. Now, I knew about alcoholism. My father was getting sober at that time. I knew it killed old dudes with cirrhosis of the liver. What I didn't want to look at was how it was killing us young, cute, adorable ones. Those of us with big blue eyes and straight teeth who were appearing on Broadway, who were living the kind of lives that people envied. Those of us who had it by the tail. What I didn't want to look at was my best friend who got drunk with me at 14 years old. As a freshman in college on a football scholarship, hanged himself because he couldn't kick a drug habit. That's alcoholism. I didn't want to acknowledge that my other best friend in New York, who was one of the cutest chorus boys on Broadway, I was the other one. He was a diabetic, and he drank like I did, and by the time he was in his mid-20s, he was blind, and he was senile, and he didn't want to live anymore, so he pulled a plug on his kidney machine, and that's how he died. That's alcoholism. Another friend of mine was a brilliant English actor named Terry, and Terry drank like I did. Terry kept killing himself. You know, he did suicide attempts. You remember suicide attempts, you know, when you take the pills and you make the phone call hoping they'll show up in time? Or you open the car door on the freeway and you lean out real slow so somebody will grab you before your face actually hits the pavement, you know. Well, Terry used to kill himself all the time. It was a joke. We'd call each other and say, oh, he's done it again. We'd all go over there and we'd kick his door in and we'd make him throw up and then we'd walk him around Central Park all night. Well, one night Terry got very, very drunk and he took a whole lot of pills and he made a phone call and the paramedic showed up in time. But they gave him just a tidge too much oxygen to bring him around and he's been a vegetable in a VA hospital for over 20 years. He now weighs about 35 pounds. He's in a full fetal position, and the only thing you can hear in his room is the machines. He doesn't have any parents, so they can't turn him off. That's alcoholism. We don't always die. Sometimes we make decisions while we're loaded that we can't get out of. But that's alcoholism. And we die from alcoholism, and it doesn't look like it. Not us young, cute, adorable ones. Because we do it with cigarettes and sofas. Or we forget to turn off the gas. Or we lose count of how much Secadol we took with how much scotch. Or we fall out of windows, or we trip in front of buses, or we hit bridge pilings at 80 miles an hour. Or we make decisions, while we're loaded, that we can't get out of. And you find us beaten to death in alleys. And that's what we're here for today, is to understand the dangers that we have lived with and we have survived. This is not a dry cocktail party. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And what we're dealing with are serious life and death issues. And I got to remember that, because sobriety gets beautiful. Sobriety gets easy. Sobriety gets wonderful. And I got to remember where I came from. And I got to remember the danger that I place myself in when I get a little relaxed about working the steps. When I let somebody else make the coffee. When I don't want to get involved in political arguments in Alcoholics Anonymous. That it's real easy for somebody like me with a little sobriety to find a career that's more important than my commitments in AA. Or a relationship that's more intense than my need to work with newcomers. And that's why I'm here. I'm here because I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm here because I came to you shattered, and you repaired me. One of the things I decided when I was 24 that I needed to do was find a good woman, and I found her in an elevator. We were going to do a show together, and she was a dancer in the show. I saw her in her leotard the first day. She was a little blonde with dimples, and she was the cutest thing I ever saw. And I looked at her, and I thought, my God, there's something about her. If I ever get involved with her, I won't ever get uninvolved. And so I started going out with somebody else. But in the meantime, we became friends. And when we became friends, we found out stuff about each other. We found out that she could do things that I couldn't do, and I could do things that she couldn't do. And we started getting closer and closer, and what we did was we kind of meshed, our character defects kind of meshed together. We were like two crippled children trying to make one decent adult out of the two of us. And our neuroses locked, and we started our dance of death. And we eventually tangoed into AA and Al-Anon, but we went around the floor for a while. We came out to California, and we got married, and she settled down. One of the things about alcoholics is we don't marry teetotalers. I didn't know anybody who didn't drink. I certainly wasn't going to marry anybody who didn't drink, and she drank. It was great. God, could she drink. It was terrific. A great-looking blonde who could drink. It was heaven. Shortly after we got married, it was cocktail hour, and she had a sip of her vodka Gibson and put it down on the coffee table and said, "This is boring," and she never drank again. She didn't go through withdrawals, nothing. It didn't bother her at all. She's not an alcoholic. And then she noticed that I drank. A lot. And then started that terrible thing that an alcoholic lives with. I was a practicing alcoholic. I needed to drink by this point. It had ceased to be a luxury for me. It was now a necessity. It was strictly medicinal. If I didn't drink, I knew that I would go insane. It was keeping me glued together, and I knew that. And I needed to drink, and I loved my wife. So what I had to do was I had to shift the responsibility a little. What I had to do was I had to make her part of my disease. Now, if love could cure alcoholism, I wouldn't need to be here, because I've been well-loved for a long time. We have loved each other for a long, long time. And we've always wanted each other to be the best possible human beings we could be. We've always wanted each other to realize our full potentials as human beings. And so I would help her. I would say things to her like, "Oh, you're going to wear that dress. You know I've always liked your hair up. I don't think you should have said that at dinner, darling. I think you upset the host." I mean, helpful things so that she could become a better human being, you know? And the clear-cut message in it was, if she was taller, if she was shorter, if she was a redhead, if she was brighter, if she wasn't so bright, if she cooked, if she worked, if she stayed home, if she gardened, if she painted, if she was somehow different, I wouldn't need to drink. And the sad thing about people who love alcoholics is she bought that. And I waited for the day when she would say, "Hold it, Sean. It's not my fault. You drink." But of course she wouldn't do that, because my disease was starting to affect her. She was shriveling in front of my eyes. The little funny, kind of forthright little dancer that I had married, the tough little blonde, was starting to wither in front of me. She was starting to get mean. She was starting to get frightened. Her fingernails were bitten to the quick. Her lips were disappearing. She was wearing the babushkas instead of getting her hair done. and she was taking out her anger on people who couldn't retaliate, like sales clerks and checkers at supermarkets. And if you looked at us as a couple, she was obviously the one who was in trouble. She was the one who was crazy. It was clear. I mean, she was angry and tight. And I was always kind of mellow, man. I kept saying, honey, relax. Have a glass of wine and a Valium. Just calm down, you know? God, it'll be all right. Yeah? I was a blackout drinker from the beginning of my drinking until the end. I never bothered to ask anybody about that. I guess I didn't want to hear the answer. And it's amazing. If you're a practicing alcoholic, what you have to do is assimilate terror. You learn how to live with it because you live with it all your life, you know? I didn't know how well I had done it until I was 5 years sober and I was standing outside my house one day. Now, I was a blackout driver. As I said, I get to talk in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot, and I'm on the freeway a lot at 11 o'clock at night after a meeting, you know, and I frequently look over at the lane next to me, and I wonder if the guy there is actually there, you know, because I wasn't. I was 5 years sober. I'm standing in the rain in the front of my house looking for the L.A. Times in my bathrobe, and I said, what the hell am I doing here? I don't care about the Times, and bam, it hit me what I was doing there. It was a ritual for my drinking. No matter how hungover I was, no matter how horrible I felt, I put on my bathrobe, I went out to the front of the house, I picked up the paper, and I walked back up the driveway and made one quick turn around the car to see if there was any blood stains or dents. I did that every morning of my life, along with showering and shaving and going to work. That horrifies me today. I didn't even notice it then. I wouldn't have even been surprised if I'd have come around the corner of that car and found the front caved in. You know? It would have been, I guess, in an odd way, a relief. And that's how it was. My world was shrinking. I'd always surrounded myself by people who drank and used worse than I did. They were becoming harder and harder to find. As long as I was driving somebody home and putting them to bed, I didn't have to look at my condition. And I was being careful about my drinking. I was now lying about it. You know, I was drinking before I went to a party so I wouldn't drink so much at the party, so people wouldn't know that I was drinking that badly. And the people who didn't know that I was a drunk thought that I was crazy because my behavior was so erratic. My behavior was nuts, you know. We'd be at some nice dinner party and I'd have one too many glasses of wine or get a bad olive or something, you know, and feel compelled to tell a hostess exactly what I thought of her boring menu and the fat Nazi she was married to. And they don't ask you back. If I was getting careful, I would start, if we were going to a party, I'd have three belts or a joint before we left. I'd have a drink before dinner, maybe a glass of wine with dinner, something afterwards, and then we would drive home, I'd get her upstairs to bed, and then I'd come down, sit in the kitchen, drink a half gallon of wine all by myself. And that's the way it was for me. It was a constant, constant nightmare, daily, of drugs and alcohol. I'd made up a couple of rules for myself that I followed faithfully into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them was that I never drank before 5 o'clock in the afternoon, except on Sundays and holidays. And the other one was that I always drank from a glass. That was very important to me because my father was a drunk and we used to find wine bottles wrapped in brown paper bags. And I knew if you drank like that, you were drunk. So I poured my Ripple into a glass. You know, it's just insane. It's just insane. 6 months before we got to the fellowships, we had a vicious fight. And I came to the next day. And she realized that there was something desperately wrong. And I could see that she was frightened. I could see that she was really frightened. I could see that the anger was gone and it was just replaced now by cold fear. And what was happening about this time was that the alcohol was no longer killing the pain. The pain was kind of sitting on the surface of my skin like sweat now. And I couldn't predict what was going to happen. I could have a half a glass of wine and be drunk out of my mind. I could drink a pint of scotch and nothing would happen. Or I'd get up in the morning and have a glass of water and be drunk again. And I couldn't predict it anymore and it was getting terrifying. And alcohol was the one that I had the most contempt for. Alcohol was the most controllable. Alcohol was the most socially acceptable. Alcohol was the one that I knew the parameters on. And it was slapping me in the face. Every time I drank now was like being dragged face down a gravel driveway. Eventually something awful would happen. And 6 months after that fight, something awful happened. I'd started praying in that time, and the prayer was, Dear God, let this stop. Dear God, let this stop. And on April 23rd, 1974, I was arrested by the West Hollywood Vice Squad on a sleazy little charge. I was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance with the front of my pants from the waistband to the knees soaked in my own urine. And I went home that night. It was 11 o'clock at night. She wasn't at home. She was out saving somebody who didn't need to be saved. and I had what I suppose is a spiritual awareness or a spiritual experience. It wasn't a white light or anything. It's just that I saw some stuff about myself very clearly. I saw that there was an enormous gap between who I was and who I wanted to be. I could see the kind of person that I wanted to be. I just couldn't see any way to bridge that gap. I also saw that somewhere along the line I had managed to commit suicide of the soul, that my pilot light had gone out. And I also understood that at a very, very deep level, that my life as I understood it was over, but I was not going to die. And I never want to feel like that again as long as I live. And I said, I wonder if I'm an alcoholic. That's the incredible thing about us drunks is our unbelievable ability to overlook overwhelming evidence. And then I said, I hope to God I am an alcoholic, because if I'm not, I'm hopelessly insane. Because I had done everything that I could do to avoid being a drunk. I had everything that keeps you from being a drunk. I was a nice upper middle class young man. You know, I'd been to psychiatrists, I'd been to groups, I'd been to religions, I had read spiritual literature, I had married above my station, I owned a house in the Hollywood Hills, I had a Mercedes-Benz, a pretty wife, a pedigree dog, a decent wardrobe, a little bit of money, a couple of friends left. I had just enough to keep me from being one of you. And it hadn't done any good. And if it wasn't alcoholism, if I wasn't an alcoholic, I was hopelessly insane. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous hoping to God that I belonged here, and embarrassed that I did. The next day at 11 o'clock in the morning on April 24th, I took aside somebody I'd been working with. We worked in the same office, and she had 6 years of sobriety, and she was having a hell of a good time. She had good days and bad days, but she seemed to be able to handle things that were just a little beyond me. And I knew she was in this program, and I knew she was an alcoholic. And I took her aside. One of the things about being sober for me is it is the greatest gift that's ever been given to me, but it's also the greatest responsibility that's ever been given to me. Because I don't know who's watching me. And I know there's someone. There's somebody watching me like I watched Suzanne. And Suzanne had no idea that I had a drinking problem. None whatsoever. Until 11 o'clock on April 24th when I took her aside in 1974. And I said the last phrase. I said, I'm an alcoholic and I have 20 minutes before I go to pieces. And she heard the screaming. And what she did was she dropped everything, she bought me a sandwich, and she took me back to her apartment, she sat me down at her dining room table, and she 12-stepped me. She 12-stepped me, a classic 12-step. And let me tell you, a 12-step is not driving somebody to a treatment center. What a 12-step is, one drunk telling his story to another drunk. And that's what she did. She sat me down at her dining room table. She had the big book on her dining room table, she read chapter 5, the 12 traditions, and chapter 3. I thought, by God, that woman is going to read that entire book. And then she told me her story. Now, my story was sleazy, but hers was disgusting. And the first miracle happened. I thought, my God, if she can stay sober, I can stay sober, you know? She looks across the table at me and she said, Sean, you can not drink for the rest of the day. And I said, of course I can. And then I thought, my God, what have I said? She looked across the table at me and she said, Sean, in order for you to stay sober, you may have to lose everything. You may have to lose your wife and your house in the hills. You may have to lose the Mercedes. You may have to lose your license. You may have to lose your bank account and your spiffy wardrobe. You may have to lose everything in order to stay sober. Are you willing to do that? And I said, yes. I don't know why I said yes, but I said yes. And I'm really grateful for that, because I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with no conditions of my sobriety. I didn't come here to save a job or a marriage. I came here to save my ass. I'm real grateful. I see people coming into this fellowship who are coming here to save their jobs and saving stuff, you know. They come in with that attitude of, I will stay sober if. I will stay sober if I get to do this. I will stay sober if she comes back. I will get to stay sober if. And what happens is the ifs come true, and it doesn't fix anything, you know. So I came here just to be sober. That's all. There was no guarantee that anything was going to work out. But if I didn't drink today, and if I tried to work the 12 steps, I wouldn't have to drink today. And she took me to my first AA meeting. It was exactly as I feared it was going to be. It was in a church basement. It had gray walls, a low ceiling. It was filled with smoke. And all those people I never would have drank with were there. There was 400 of them that night. We have real big meetings in AA in Southern California. The first three meetings I went to were 400 to 500 people each. And Now, if you're here to get your act together, let me tell you how I arrived. I came in my Mercedes. I had on a $250 sports jacket from Saks Fifth Avenue. That was 15 years ago, so it was an expensive jacket. I had on French gabardine slacks, Italian loafers, and a designer tie. I'd been paid several hundred dollars for a day's work as a model not long before I got here. I looked fabulous when I walked into my first meeting. Everybody in the place knew that I was a drunk, and I couldn't figure that out. There were a couple of things going on that night that I wasn't aware of. One of them was it was a rather warm April night. I had been drinking straight vodka the night before, and I had on a lot of lemon-lime cologne, and I smelled like a gimlet. The other thing that was going on was I had newcomer eyes. Now, the only other place I've ever seen eyes like that, other than on a newcomer in AA, are on a dog loose on a freeway. I was absolutely terrified. Now, I had had a serious discussion with Suzanne that afternoon, and what I had explained to her was that I felt that drinking was definitely the problem, but the way that I should get sober was that I should kind of drift down into sobriety on a little pink cloud of Valium. You know, I should kind of touch down lightly, you know, because I knew the withdrawal would be horrifying. You know, I'd been taking a lot of drugs and everything, and, you know, we could kind of taper off into sobriety here thing, And she looked across that dining room table at me 15 years ago, and she said, "Sean, in Southern California, we define sobriety as clean and sober." I was real disappointed at that news. But thank God for it, because she had done exactly what I had done before she got to the fellowship, and she understood the requirements for sobriety for somebody like me. And since I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of people who have come along who are like me, a lot of people who have expanded the definition of alcoholism, those of us who tried to turn ourselves into toxic chemical waste dumps. Those of us who didn't have that knee-jerk fear of drugs that the older generation had. Those of us who have found out a hell of a lot about stuff that a lot of people in this fellowship have never experienced. And luckily for me, the woman who 12-stepped me had done that. And so she understood that sobriety for me was a little more stringent than it had been for the ones that had followed before me. And it is for the ones who have come after me. And if you're new here, and you're not drinking, but you're smoking a little grass, or you're doing the odd line of coke, or you're popping the odd Valium, or doing a lot of Secanol, or Tuinol, or anything at all, you're taking a little NyQuil, a little terpenhydrate of codeine, a little designer heroin, a little a little amyl nitrate. Keep coming back. We just love visitors. But do not for a second think that you're sober because you are not. And I want to make that real clear, because I have buried some very nice people in the last 15 years who have said things like, "There's nothing about marijuana in the big book." And that's absolutely true. There is nothing about marijuana in the big book. There's also nothing about nuclear submarines or electric pencil sharpeners in the big book either. The people who wrote the big book had enough humility to realize they know only a little. They told us more would be revealed. And in the last 54 years, a hell of a lot has been revealed about alcoholism. A lot has been revealed about alcoholism. Its interconnection with a lot of other stuff. However, in the last 54 years, there's been nothing more effective the treatment of alcoholism than what was put down in that big book in the late 30s. We've got all the statistics, you know. Now, there's certainly some exceptions to what I just said. I don't propose that anybody go through open-heart surgery while biting on a bullet. That's nonsense. There are medical procedures that require pain meds and all kinds of stuff. There are also some chronic illnesses that require stuff like that. There are also people who have problems other than alcoholism. There are people who have mental disorders that requires psychotropics in order for them to be sane enough to be sober. And I understand those. And if you fall into that category, I suggest you find a sponsor who knows something about that and a doctor who knows something about alcoholism, and the three of you go and discuss it. However, most psychiatrists who have any ethics and know anything about alcoholism, which is a very rare commodity, know that you cannot double diagnose an alcoholic in their first year of sobriety. Mainly because when you take away the anesthetic, we manifest every psychological disorder known to man. When you take away alcohol and drugs from an alcoholic, you have a lunatic on your hands. Look at anybody in their first year of sobriety. When I was 6 months sober, I was crazier than I had ever been in my entire life. I was clearly manic depressive. I mean, one day I was, and the next day I was thinking about suicide. I was paranoid. I knew there were large groups of people talking about me, usually members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had developed an eating disorder. That's my favorite double diagnosis. I gained 35 pounds in my first year of sobriety because I ate gallons of ice cream. When you stop consuming gallons of vodka, you got to replace the sugar somehow, and I did it with Haagen-Dazs ice cream. I blew up like the Pillsbury Doughboy. After somebody's got a year of sobriety and they've worked the steps, if they still got the same psychological disorders they arrived with, then perhaps we should seek some other professional help. But it's amazing how things get cured around here by the attendance of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, sharing within the fellowship and working the steps. Now, one of the problems that we've got in Alcoholics Anonymous is there's some old-timers that don't like people like me talking about drugs, and I understand that because it hasn't been part of their story, and it's not part of their recovery. But there is something that you must understand if you're new and you don't have if you're old and you don't have this experience, is that you have the thing that keeps us here, you old-timers. You have the commodity that us newcomers need to know about, and that is sober experience. What we need to know once we arrive here is how do we stay here. So I beg you, old-timers, do not withhold your experience because you disapprove of how we got here. Because you are the ones who keep us here. You are the ones who keep us here. You are the ones who change and grow and have experiences and bring them back to meeting and tell us how you did it. Now, on the other hand, those of you who are new, let me tell you something about Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. That's terrific. Now, if you come here, and we have this in our groups, you know, addicts. I love addicts. I mean, I just absolutely love them. You know, my favorite ones are cocaine addicts. That's alcoholism as an economic issue. You know, I love it.
Ooh, I lost my Jaguar and went to a meeting.
Yeah. Addicts are just hysterical. I mean, first, have you ever listened to an addict tell you his drug-a-log? I mean, first of all, you got to be a chemist to listen to the goddamn thing, you know. The measurements, the grams and the kilos and the bip and the bop, you know. And they were all dealers. Nobody was buying. I don't know, you know, they were all selling. I don't know who the hell was buying this thing. You know, so you listen to all the crap, you know, it's fine, you know. So if you're an addict, come to our open meetings, sit down, shut up and listen, you know. And if nobody gets hysterical and says, you can't be here, what happens is those addicts sit in our open meeting. And they start listening to the causes and conditions. They start hearing the language of this heart. They start hearing the emotional content of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happens is that if they stick around, within a couple of months, they become addict alcoholics. And then as soon as they identify themselves as alcoholics, no matter how hyphenated the identification is, they get to do things like read chapter 5. They get to lead a meeting. They get to make coffee. They get to participate. They get to join the fellowship. And then what happens after a couple of months is they become alcoholic addicts. And then what happens is their sponsor tricks them into getting into general service. And they start getting in contact with the traditions. And they start understanding that the people in service are the guardians of traditions that make it possible for these rooms to be here for the newcomers. And eventually what they become is alcoholics. Because what they find out is that there are two parts to the name of this organization, Alcoholics Anonymous. And what they find out about is anonymity. What they find out about is anonymity is the spiritual principle whereby I give up my need to distinguish myself, either within this fellowship or out there. And what that means is I get to stand up at a podium or I get to be in a meeting and explore what is the same about you and me. not celebrate our differences. So I don't get up at a podium and double identify, because I don't want you to get some kind of subtle message that my case is different, because my case is not different. The wonderful thing about participating in Alcoholics Anonymous is I get to find out that emotionally I'm the same as everybody in this room. And that has given me a sense of belonging that I had never experienced in my entire life. I actually belong in a place with a group of people. And what a wondrous group of people. I've met all kinds of people. My world was confined by my fear. What I sought out were people exactly the same as me. People who wouldn't challenge me. People who wouldn't put me down. People who were exactly the same as me. And what I did was I built up a wall of prejudice to keep out anybody who was different from me. And what you did was you shoved me into these rooms with a styrofoam cup of coffee and forced me to deal with people that I had never met. And then you told me I had to find out what was the same about us. And I started doing that. And what happened is it made me feel part of the world. That's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think there's a big, huge controversy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think fear causes people to do silly things, like write new preambles and make new rules that aren't necessary. We don't need any more literature, I don't think, to address the problem, because I think the problem's been solved. And the problem's been solved, by the way, all the problems get solved in Alcoholics Anonymous, with love and with tolerance. If I can learn to tolerate you, I can learn to tolerate me. If I can learn to like you, I can learn to like me. If I can learn to love you, I can learn to love me. I met my sponsor the first night that I was sober. I was sitting in this here meeting. On one side was this little black guy named Jimmy, and Jimmy had been sober for a long time, 15, 16 years, and Jimmy had problems other than alcoholism. He loved to talk to the speaker when the speaker talked. I was sitting there in my little sports jacket, and Jimmy was sitting next to me going, yeah, 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 yeah. We sing Happy Birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern California, and he loved to sing Happy Birthday at the top of his lungs, off tune. And the birthday part came, and he sang Happy Birthday very loudly, off tune. And I thought, this is what the rest of my life is going to be like. The guy on the other side of me, his name is Jack, and he took my hand, and he shook it, and he wouldn't let go. You do that, you know. And he said, I'm not a psychiatrist, but if you call me tonight and you tell me how you feel and I tell you how I feel, probably neither of us will have to get loaded. And I started calling him. One of the things that he did that night and over the next couple of days was he started telling me his story, and his story was exactly the same as mine. It was an AA miracle. An AA miracle. I sat down next to the person who was exactly the same as me, who had almost 3 years of sobriety, and he became my sponsor. Now, one of the things that had happened that afternoon with Suzanne is, as I was telling her my story, she kept jumping up and running out of the room. And I thought she was one of those ones with kidney damage. What I found out 3 years later was the reason Jack's story was exactly the same as mine was, as I was telling it to Suzanne, she was going into her bedroom and calling Jack and telling it to him. More will be revealed. See, if you're new, the old-timers around here talk about rigorous honesty, and then they lie to you. And the way they get away with it is they say, more will be revealed. If anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous says, more will be revealed, they're lying. Yeah. And thank God, you know. And they shoved the steps down my throat because I'm not the kind that makes this program. I'm too cute and I'm too bright and I got too much going for me. I understand I got this little drinking problem, but let's keep it light. You know? I'm the kind that gets a six-month chip and says something incredibly spiritual, sits down, and is never seen again. And they recognized that about me. And so what they did was they shoved the steps down my throat. They didn't tell me what they were about. They didn't tell me what the results would be. They didn't try to explain them or make me understand them. They just said, take them. And I started doing it. When I was 3.5 weeks sober, I started my fourth step. When I was 6 weeks sober, I took my fifth step. And by the time I was 6 to 8 months sober, I had done the 12 steps the first time. And that's the way it was for me, and I'm very, very grateful for that, because they grounded me as firmly as they could, because I'm the kind that drift. Now, I thought I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the minute I got here, but I didn't. I've always mistaken emotions. That first meeting, I didn't love Alcoholics Anonymous, but what I did feel was safety. I felt safe in that meeting. I felt understood and accepted. I got it at a very deep level that whatever I had to do in order to stay sober, these people would be available to me. And so I felt safe. And that's gone on ever since. Once I get into a meeting and sit down with my coffee, I'm safe for an hour and a half or however long the meeting goes on. And it's odd, though, that for the first couple of years, I was embarrassed about being an Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why it was more embarrassing to be an Alcoholics Anonymous than it was to throw up at your Christmas tree, but there you have it, you know. I was none too tightly wrapped. The first three steps were very important to me, and I took them very rapidly in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new and if you're having trouble with them, let me just briefly go over them for you. The principles behind the first three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I understand them and for me, are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And the honesty part of step one was that I had realized that I was powerless over alcohol, that I could no longer predict the effect of the drug, that once I had something to drink, I could no longer tell you with any certainty what I was going to do. It was that simple, you know. We could all go to a bar and have a drink, and you'd go home to your wives. And I'd say that I was going to do that, but I couldn't be sure. And so it was clear that it was unmanageable. I mean, I no longer could predict it at all. My life had become unmanageable was significant. And I didn't understand for a long time why my life was unmanageable, except that when you're a practicing alcoholic like me, what I'd done was I'd spent my life defending myself against you. What I decided was that if I'd accumulated all the right things, it would protect me somehow. If I had the right woman and the right car and the right house and the right wardrobe and the right job, you couldn't hurt me, you know? And I built out a wall. I built up a wall of possessions, things that made me appear to be okay. The only problem is that if you build a wall to protect yourself, it becomes a prison. And what had happened to me by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was that I had become my own prisoner and my own jailer. There was an inside of me that was saying, you've got to let somebody know you're in trouble, Sean. And there was an outside that was saying, don't you dare let on, because if they find out, they'll throw you away. And that's the kind of conflict I was living with. So if you make protective decisions all your life, you never get to make any decisions based on hope and trust and goodwill. And so the life becomes unmanageable. The life turns on itself, and that's what had happened to me. The second step was that I came to believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. Now, my arrogance when I first got sober told me that the only power greater than me was God. It was me, and then there was God. I'd like to thank you for your input, but I'm talking to God today. Yeah. I'm always nervous of those guys in Alcoholics Anonymous who are talking directly to God. Yeah. I've never heard from God. Never gotten a message on my service. Never gotten a postcard from Puerto Vallarta. Nothing, you know? What I had to acknowledge was that somebody with 20 minutes more sobriety than me was a power greater than me. That a room full of drunks like this is a power greater than me. That the big book is a power greater than me. That the fellowship in general is a power greater than me. That my sponsor was a power greater than me. And that there were all powers that were designed to lead me to the power that I needed to find out. Could restore me to sanity was a little difficult for me because I'm a nice upper middle class drunk. And we don't go to funny farms. We go to therapists and talk about stress. And they give us prescriptions. And I thought insanity was rubber rooms and paper slippers and no doorknobs on this side, you know, and that hadn't been my experience. And what happened was I was going to a meeting with a friend of mine, and he had a big old medical dictionary on his desk, and I thumbed through it. I was a couple of weeks sober. And I looked up a definition of insanity, and the definition of insanity was about this long, and out of the middle of it popped a phrase. And this is the phrase. It's a medical definition of insanity. Quote, a seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. Close quote. A seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. I had led a disastrous life and had learned nothing. Learned nothing. I kept repeating the same thing over and over and over again, convinced that this time the results would be different. My life was a circle that kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. I took the second step right there, right then. I clearly qualified. And then I was faced with the third step. Now, the third step is always difficult for people like you and me because we've lived lives that we don't approve of, you know, ultimately. And I had been, the idea of turning my will and my life over to God as I understand it was difficult for me. First of all, I thought you had to understand God to do it. And that's not what that step talks about. God, as you understand it, means no matter how diminished your understanding is, turn it over. You know, that's what, if you don't understand anything, turn it over. You know? And I've been raised an Irish Catholic as opposed to a Roman Catholic. And Bonnie's a Polish Catholic, and she says there is a difference. Yeah. By the time I was 24 years old, I had broken every one of the Ten Commandments, and that's a biggie for a former altar boy. And that's when I became spiritually lost. I didn't know that for years and years and years, but that's when my drinking and my using took a nosedive. And what I did was I parked God like an old Plymouth, and whenever I was in trouble, I'd go find him. You know, I learned those two alcoholic prayers. I don't know if I can do them now. Let me think. The first one is, you got to be real sincere about it. Dear God, get me out of this and I will never do it again. And the second alcoholic prayer is, whew. I was an agnostic when I arrived. No, I love agnostics, you know. I was an agnostic not out of conviction, but out of convenience. See, I was in deep shit with God, so I decided to demand further proof of his existence. Hit me with that lightning! You know? It's nuts. But my sponsor told me that I was going to have to pray. He said, you're going to have to search for God on a daily basis. You'll probably never find God, but you got to search on a daily basis. And I said, how do you do that? And he told me, and it was humiliating. He said I had to do it on my knees because I was one of the arrogant ones. I don't know how I figured that out. So I did it. It was awful. It was absolutely awful. What I'd do is I'd get up in the morning, I'd go in the bathroom, I'd lock the bathroom door, and I'd get down on my knees and say, okay, God, keep me sober and let me know what you want me to do today. And then I'd get up and look around. Unlock the bathroom door and walk out. Then at night I'd go and lock the bathroom door, get down on my knees and say, thank you, God, for keeping me sober. And then I'd get up, look around, unlock the bathroom door, walk out. I left the bathroom door open when I puked, but I locked it when I prayed. And nothing happened. Nothing happened. I didn't feel any better, you know, until I had what I believe was my first spiritual experience. I was 6 months sober. I told you about being 6 months sober. I was nuts when I was 6 months sober. I was sober. I was going to meetings. I was working the steps. I was talking to my sponsor every day. I was driving people to meetings. Most afternoons, you could see me driving up and down the Hollywood Freeway in my Mercedes in a three-piece suit, screaming at the top of my lungs because it was the only thing that would kill the pain. And when I wasn't doing that, I was taking naps. Now, I don't know about you, but I tried as best I could to sleep through my entire first year of sobriety. If I couldn't get loaded, I was going to get out somehow, you know. A whole day of reality was more than I could handle. I don't know about you, you know. I was a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife who worked. And So I took a lot of naps. And I was 6 months sober, and I was trying to take a nap, and I couldn't, and I was absolutely furious. And I looked up at the ceiling, and I said, I don't believe in you, and I think you're a jerk! Then it occurred to me, if I didn't believe, who was I yelling at? And then being a good ex-Catholic, I waited for 3 weeks to find out if I was going to get punished for calling him a jerk. And I didn't. I didn't get punished. What happened was it broke a very old idea of God. I had an idea of a God that was out there and up there. And what started to form out of that was the idea that maybe I was carrying around a little microchip of God within me. That maybe there was something going on in here. Something that needed to be nursed and nurtured. Something that needed to glow, you know? And I'd been raised in a tradition that if it wasn't Lourdes, it wasn't a miracle. So what I decided to do was lower my standards on miracles. And I started listening in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in a different way. I started listening to the language of the heart. I started hearing you talk about taking quantum leaps as human beings. Things that were impossible by the force of will. You started talking about relationships being repaired. Children coming back into your lives. Jobs being gotten and held. You know? Started hearing about you becoming functional human beings. People who were more shattered than I was were doing okay. And I gathered those as miracles. I would gather them up like a squirrel gathers nuts to shore up this frail, frail non-belief. Now, if you're new and you're listening to me and you're thinking, my God, you know, all these insights that I'm sharing with you are hindsights. I have never known what was going on at the time, you know? I don't know how I feel right now, you know? Ask me in a week, I'll be able to tell you, you know? But I've never been able to, you know, the wonderful thing about being sober for a while is there's this big thing in AA that the reason we get sober is to get in touch with our feelings. Well, I found out that my feelings get in touch with me quite handily. And also, the longer I've been sober, it's not really too terribly important how I feel. What is much more important to me now is how I act. So all these things that happen, you know, I would be sitting out there when I was listening to these speakers, and I'd say, I'm 6 months sober, and I don't know what's going on. And he said he knew what was going on. I knew what was going on when I was 6 months sober, when I was about a year and a half sober, you know. So anyway, what happened is I started getting a sense of some kind of spiritual stuff going on here. And it embarrassed me. I didn't like to talk about it. It took me a long time to get into meditation. I was willing to turn my will and life over to God, but I didn't want to get too close to the source. You know, it just kind of made me nervous. And I kept on with this fellowship, and we kept living the lives, you know, and going on. When I was five and a half years sober, I was very, very sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's something that happens at 5 years that doesn't get talked about much in Alcoholics Anonymous because there isn't a lot of literature on it. The big book was written before most of the guys were 5 years sober, and then there's some literature written a long time after that. But a lot of us at 5 years hit a wall. It's a lot like runners do in marathon races. You know, they talk about hitting a wall at a certain mile. And I think a lot of us do that at 5 years. And when I was 5 years sober, I was very, very sober. I was talking from podiums. I was sponsoring guys. I was getting to be known in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was very sober. And I knew I could teach this program. And what I decided to do, and I didn't know that I had made the decision, but what I decided to do was explore the fence lines of my sobriety. What I wanted to do was find out how far I could go before I get drunk. What I didn't know that I was trying to find out how much pain I could stand, where the edge was, and what happened when I was 5 and a half years sober is I blew my life apart. I was arrested again. I was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance, and it's not as much fun sober. And I went home, and Bonnie came home from her Al-Anon meeting, and I told her what had happened. And she had the oddest reaction. She didn't start screaming. She didn't start accusing. What she did was she reached across the table and she put her hand on my face and she said, "Oh, Sean, I'm so sorry that you have to hurt yourself so badly." And then she said, "I don't know what your needs are, but I do know what mine are, Sean. And I need you to be faithful and supportive if I'm going to be married to you because I love you. If you can't be faithful and supportive, then I can't be married to you because I love you." And what happened is I was faced with a decision. And I talked to my sponsor. Did a little tense step on it. And we retook our wedding vows. And we started repairing a marriage that somehow had gone wrong somewhere and we didn't even know why. But we started really doing the kind of grisly kind of spade work that I needed to do that I had been avoiding doing until that time. And a lot of changes came out of it. When I was 8 years sober, my daughter was born. And because we had found that fear of change was no longer a reason not to have a family. And so we started on that. And she's a joyous child. She's a wonderful child. And my daughter provided the last step, I think, for me in a kind of spiritual journey for me. Because you have beautiful, intelligent children. But I have Kate. And I love Kate. I love Kate with the kind of love that I didn't think was possible for somebody like me because I don't love well and I don't love easily. But I love Kate. And I don't love her because she's perfect. I love her because she's mine. And I believe that if I am capable of loving like that, with my diminished ability to love, I wonder what God's capable of. I wonder what God's capable of. See, they talk about us being made in the image of God, and I don't believe it's how we look. I believe it's our ability to love. That's what the image of God is. I believe that God is total love. And the part of us that is able to love is what's God-like. See, I don't believe anymore that God cares whether I'm drunk or sober. I don't believe that God cares whether I'm good or bad. I believe that God just cares. That there's an endless resource of hope and love and trust for me, and all I've got to do is tap into it. All I've got to do is turn and face the sun. And I've lived in the shadows for so long, and I've been so frightened for so long, that it's so wonderful to step out. It's so wonderful to step out. And the only way I've ever been able to do it is to take your hand. And we all step out together. We come here shattered. We come here damaged people. And what happens is we get repaired here. And sometimes the places where we're repaired are stronger than they were before they were broken, and sometimes they're weaker. And unfortunately, I don't know what were the stronger parts of me and the weaker parts of me. So what I have to do is I have to depend on your experience and your knowledge. And so I ask for it all the time, because you're the resource for me. You're the only people who've been able to teach me anything, because you started off by saying, I know how you feel. And I searched my whole life for somebody who knew how I felt. And I found it here. I found it with bikers, and I found it with bankers. And I found it with Skid Row bums, and I found it with actors. And I found it with women, and I found it with men. I found it in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as long as I live, it won't be enough that I can do to repay you. I desperately need you people. I need you more now than I did then, because I got more at stake now. I think I have more fears now than I had when I was new, because I got a much wider life. I've got much more at stake. What I have found is that God doesn't take away fear. God gives courage. And you're the people with it. You're the miracle people. You're the miracle people. Because what you do is you reach out your hand and you say, I know how you feel. So please, if it's not enough for you today, keep coming back for me. God bless you. Yeah.